Interview with Eva Pierakos on February 8, 1976, on the way back to New York in a car. Interviewed by Charles Rothmill.
Okay, the first question I have is, if you can describe, this is before even, this is the before history, the specific milieu you grew up in.
Boy. well, my father was a then very famous writer. He's still quite famous in Europe, even after all this time.
Not that's Herman Brock, right?
No, that was my father-in-law,
Jacob Wasser.
And he was had a fantastic, it was really a fantastic environment. There's Thomas Mann and Bruno Walter and Hermann Hesse and Arthur Schnitzel and all these very, I mean, it was the elite, the intellectual elite in Vienna. And I developed a sort of anti-intellectual attitude out of protest. Probably that was then my form of rebellion. But at the same time, it was also a very beautiful environment in that sense. It was very cultured and very... we had money without being rich, but we had very luxurious life. And we had an estate in the country where my father lived with his second wife. We had a villa in Vienna, a very beautiful villa. And I grew up in both houses.
How old were you then?
Well, actually, this is my personal history.
Yeah.
My parents divorced when I was very small. And I hardly have any memory when they were together. And ever since I can remember, they were in lawsuits and absolute hatred between them. And in some way, of course it had an effect on me, but not conscious at that time. I was a fairly happy child, except that I felt extremely uncomfortable anytime I saw my parents together. That was agony. And otherwise, my stepmother I got along with. She was a hard, cold woman. I actually didn't like her, but I thought I liked her. she's a very elegant woman and very femme du monde, you know. Yeah. And I lived 3 months in the summer with my father, and then Christmas and New Year's, Christmas and Easter, and the rest of the time I stayed in Vienna with my mother.
Okay, now what was the religious atmosphere at the
time?
None.
I mean, my parents, neither one of them were atheists. They believed somehow in God, but there was no talk about it or no... there was a Christian orientation, but most of us... there was no religious education.
Well, at that time, what was your concept of God as a child and maybe as a teenager?
I didn't have any.
No.
I didn't think about it.
Did you have any inkling or forewarning of anything unusual happening?
Not in the least,
okay.
To put it mildly.
It's important.
On the contrary, I was very worldly. I was very unspiritual. I was completely out-oriented. Anybody talking about things like a psychic phenomena or so, I would giggle.
Yeah.
I was very superficial in certain ways, you know.
Right. Now, what were your early aspirations at the time?
I wanted to become a dancer, and I started ballet as a child. And as a very young girl, I started with my dancing school. There were some performances, and I performed. And then my father, who was very perfectionistic in these things, he said, if you are not a first-rate dancer or any artist, then you're better not. I mean, we don't know that now. Give it up for 2 years. If you really have it in you to be a great dancer, you will resume. And I didn't take it up, so obviously that was not my calling.
No.
But I always kept at it in some form or another.
Like you still dance nowadays?
Yes, right.
No. Do you remember, this is just a question, do you remember any strong dreams in early childhood?
Yes, I had some strong dreams, but none. They had nothing to do with any foreshadowing of a task or anything like that. Nothing. It came much later.
Okay. Do you remember any major events in your childhood that had an impact on you? I guess the divorce might have been one.
Well, the divorce was so... actually, the divorce... the real thing of the impact was a steady climate of hate between my parents and of lawsuits and alimony suits and absolute dissension between my father and my mother. That was a steady climate. But somehow I got accustomed to it, you know, I sort of adjusted to it. I couldn't even imagine any other life. And that was in a way like, you know, my two older brothers and older sister, in a sense, there was quite a bit of difference in age between us, and they were much older when this happened, and they suffered much more, because when they were, they still remembered how my father and mother lived together, and it must have been very painful, you know?
Yeah.
And they had much more of a trauma from it than I, who didn't even remember them, you know? I mean, it was much, that's why I always say it's better for parents to divorce if they don't get along than to stay together for the child, you know? It's such a silly cliche to say it's stay together for the children. It doesn't even make sense. So I don't know if I answer. When I answer you, Charles, if all of that, you know, it's probably not all.
No, I think, that is good. And I think it's, these were questions that felt covered the early part. Okay. Now. Well, how old were you or when you had a first sign of change, you know, something happening?
Well, it wasn't really a change. It wasn't, I'll tell you, well, I have to repeat then what I said in the tape of the meeting. I was still a very, very young girl, my late teens maybe, when once through other kids, one of the kids, mother was a spiritist who did the table wrapping, and we did that.
Oh.
And it was in the south of France. And we did it for fun, you know, the table really started moving and wrapping and giving answers, and actually it was like a levitation, it lifted up. I didn't understand that at the time, you know. And that was, you know, it was like kids playing, and we didn't know they were really playing with fire. And it was broad daylight, it was in the bungalow of one of the girls, and the table pushed itself to me and almost hit me in the stomach. And I know there was no cheating possible, I was very suspicious. We looked under the table, but there was just these other two girls and me. And that was the only phenomenon I remember.
And then
I would ask, I had no idea what caused it. I didn't really believe in spirits. And I had no idea what caused it. And once in a while, I would ask people, you know, who were perhaps more knowledgeable. And I would tell them about it, and I would ask them, what is this? What made this move? And nobody could give me an intelligent answer. They would sort of beat around the bush. And then somebody would once say, that was the only thing, would quote Shakespeare and say, well, there are more things between heaven and earth than we can dream about. And that was the only thing I had sort of an inkling. Maybe there's some kind of force involved that we don't know about. And I let it go at that, you know. It was during the war, and I didn't think about it more.
Now,
and then that only came much, much later. And that was when I was in Switzerland, after I was in America, the first time I was in Switzerland. And that was in 1952. And I think that's on the tape, you know.
No, but I tell you, I'd like to
ask.
You
want to hear it again?
Yeah, well, no, let me go in order, okay. Sort of. You mean to say, you went after you were in America, it happened?
Yes.
Okay, now,
how
did you come to America?
Well, my first husband's father, who was also a very famous writer, Hermann Brock, gave us a danger visa because we were in France at the time of the occupation. And at that time it was before I was married, but then we married when we came here. And so I came to America, I mean, that was 1941.
And what made you stay?
What made me stay?
Oh, you mean you just stayed for,
yeah,
no.
I became a citizen.
Well, I'll tell you, Judy asked me to ask you that. She said
Judy,
you had sailing. She said,
Judith, yeah.
She said you had an interesting story with her. How did you come to the USA? She told about
what story? Oh, she means maybe that in France I was for a time in a, you know, the French concentration camp in Gurs. Does she mean that?
No, I don't think so. What is that? Well, I don't know. What is that?
Well, I don't think it has anything.
Okay. Now, when you went back to Switzerland, what happened? Like, you want to mention something about automatic handwriting?
Okay, yeah. Well, that's all on the tape, really, but I have to do it again. Couldn't you take it from the tape?
Well, I'm trying to get a version out that would be good technically, too, that people could hear.
Well, okay. In 1951, which was about a year before I had the first manifestation, I was in Zurich with my mother, my sister, the man I was then living with, which was André, this Russian prince, with whom I had a very intense relationship, but we couldn't get married because he didn't get a divorce. It was between my first and second husband. And my mother told us she has this friend, a woman, who goes to this medium. And and she said, well, maybe we might want to go. And we said, oh, yes, yes, let's go. That's fun, you know, like going to a movie. And she said, but you have to promise, she knew me, she said, you have to promise one thing, she said. She takes this seriously and you mustn't laugh. And that's the way I went. And then we went to this medium there, and I was all prepared to laugh, but there was something that affected me, that I said, gee, that's not to laugh. And I somehow, something in me made me take it seriously. And I listened, and then I went to their lectures, you know, they had these trance lectures. And I went occasionally, but you know, I never had any idea of any such thing happening to me, God forbid. The last thing in the world I wanted. But I was interested, and I started reading books, you know, about psychic phenomena and spirit communication, and I opened my mind to these possibilities, and I was interested in it. And then the same woman who took us there, and we talked about reincarnation, that made sense to me, I believed in that. And then this woman who took us there, she said, then I learned about these things, that there's automatic writing and things like that. And she said, well, she had once done some automatic writing, but then it had become very dangerous because she couldn't handle it. But now she feels she's up to do it again, and that one shouldn't do that alone, but would I be interested in sitting with her? And I said, fine, you know, I didn't have anything better to do, so twice a week I sat with her, and she started automatic writing. And that was going on for a while. And then I had a very interesting... Yeah, then I started meditating for the first time in my life. And then I had a very interesting experience once. I forgot about that. I was sitting meditating. It was summer in the open window. And suddenly, that was really the first sign of something. Oh, no, there was something else I forgot. You asked me about signs.
What year are you talking about?
Well, that was in 1951-52. That was already, it was between 1951 and 52. But before, I think it was in 1950. That was before.
It doesn't matter. Really.
Yeah. I had, before all that manifested, I had an experience that I could say was some kind of a sign.
Yeah.
Because I had any connection before I went to this medium or anything like that. It was, again, I was in Zurich there, and it was New Year's Eve. And you know, in Switzerland, New Year's Eve, they ring all the church bells, the very beautiful church bells. And I opened the window, people opened the windows, you know. And I think at that time I was alone, because Andre was somewhere on business. And I opened the windows for to let in the New Year's and the church bell ring. And then I felt an incredible power, like the Christ power, you know, like angels were there. And I didn't even have any concepts of such things. But it was something so strong that it forced me on my knees.
Wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't incredible. And then I put that aside, I completely forgot it. Mm-hmm. But that was like a heralding what was to come. In that same year that came, I was guided to this medium, at that time not even knowing the meaning of it. And then this thing with the automatic writing with this woman started. And then that was all coming very quickly, you know, it was in 1951. And, or two, at the beginning of 1952 maybe. And then, where we stop now, huh?
Yeah, stop. Okay, I'll tell you,
where were we?
We were just at the beginning of the handwriting, automatic handwriting. And
then I told you about the two major events,
window and
with the window. I was sitting at the window, and that's another thing I didn't mention on the tape of mediumship. I forgot about that. The two things I forgot. The second thing was this. I was sitting and meditating, and suddenly it was in the summer. And that had happened several times, not just once. I smelled this incredible scent. And it was not, you know, it was not a scent that came from any real thing. I mean, I looked around at the outside. I cannot even describe that scent. It was really a spiritual scent, and yet it was very real and earthy. And it gave me such an unbelievable feeling. I can't describe it. If anything, it was a combination like of, there was no incense, I had no incense, but it was a little bit like sandalwood, and then some like a metallic smell in it that was unbelievable. It was like, I would imagine angels smell like that, you know? Yeah.
All
right. That happened to me, and I was so puzzled. But along with that scent, I knew this had some kind of a spiritual meaning. And I put it aside, and that was, you know, but it was a very strong thing. And then, maybe a few months after that, a few weeks, I don't remember the time, it must have been early summer, but in the summer of 1952, in August, I was still in Switzerland. One day also I was sitting home and meditating, and suddenly my hand got very heavy, my right hand. And I was sitting so like this, you know, with my elbows up on the table, my head on the forehead. And suddenly my hand was like pulled down and moving on its own accord. And I took a pencil, and it moved. And I got so excited, I said, gee, my God, what's this? And I don't want to do automatic writing, but at the same time, I was very fascinated. And it didn't do much, you know, it was just lines. And once in a while, my name. And lines, straight lines, diagonally across the paper. But the fact that something moved beyond my volition was exciting and frightening and fascinating and very intriguing. And then the next day I went to this friend, you know, this woman who knew about it, when she had done it. And she took it very matter of fact. She said, well, then you start automatic writing.
Wow.
And then we started regularly sittings, you know, after all, twice a week or three times a week. And that is all on the tape. I don't know.
But what sort of message? Were you getting any kind of messages
then? Well, that's all on the tape, Charles. I don't really think I have to repeat it. It's very lengthy. I mean, then came a lot of different handwritings and messages and confusions. But I really think that's on the tape, and I don't have to repeat that.
Okay.
It's tedious to repeat. You know?
All right. Now, did you feel it was sort of a crisis at that point?
No.
Or?
No. was just a very interesting pastime. It never occurred to me that I would this would become what it would become. You know, it would never occur to me in a million years. Then.
Well, what about that, something about a drawing that somebody made of one of your family members?
Oh, well, no, that wasn't me. You see, these were experiences I had in this spiritual group in Switzerland when I, before the this manifested with me, when I was still very doubtful. And that's also on the tape. It was I don't want to repeat it.
Not many people know it, and it's not very audible on that tape.
Oh, yes.
You don't think it's okay?
It's horrible. And then there was the healing I saw with Harry Edwards. And now these things give me a fantastic conviction that there are things like that. And, you know, but it's very tiring.
All right, now here's a question I want to ask you. When the guide started to come through you, you know, you went through a period where he told you that you had to go through your own purification before you extend.
Well, let me go a little bit back on it.
Okay.
Well, at the beginning of the automatic writing, as I said, there was a lot of writing, a lot of tests, a lot of different entities coming through, and a total mixture of levels. There were very low-grade spirits. I had to learn not to believe what they said, to have a lot of it, the discrimination, and not just to take everything hook, line, and sinker. I was very often tempted to throw the whole thing aside. I said, oh, that's a hoax. It's maybe the church is right. You shouldn't have anything to do with that. It's too confusing. Then there were, in between, you know, messages coming through that were really from a point of view of phenomenon, incredible. Things I couldn't know that I verified were true. That really were humanly impossible for me to, things I never believed, you know, that couldn't be, and I can't possibly go into all the details about
okay.
that. They turned out to be true. Things that I believed turned out to be false. Predictions, at that time I didn't know you shouldn't bother with predictions. A lot of stuff, and maybe then little by little I learned how to handle these things, to question these spirits, to learn that there, many of them are very lost spirits and they need help and they lie like human beings, or they, you know, they pretend they are something they are not, and I did that. It took me a lot of time before I found that out. Then, very gradually, little by little, once in a while, what happened?
Sorry.
Once in a while, a writing came through that was very different. And that I later learned was the guide, you know, with fantastic advice for my personal development. But didn't come very often, and it really tested me that it was mixed in with this other stuff. And it was an unbelievable training for me at this early stage handle that, to learn how to handle that, you know. And there was so much groping and so much confusion. And at one point I said, no, I give that up. It's too much. I can't handle that. It's too much. And I gave it up. And when I gave it up, I had this unbelievable bad feeling, like something, a light had gone out in me, a coldness in me, a darkness in me, and this feeling was like I did something wrong, you know. And then after 2 days or so, you know, soul searching, I said, well, maybe that's not the right thing. I resumed it, and it, then I felt good again because it was the right thing. Oh, and another thing I forgot, that with that automatic writing, around the same time, something that might be called clairaudience developed, where I could really, but not hear voices in the sense like you hear voices, but like the writing was inside of me, like a knowledge inside of me, of a knowledge that's not in my brain, you know. I could reveal. Later on, this turned out to be my channel. It was like the first inklings of the openings of the channel. Inside, you know, and so all that happened in these few months. A lot of things happened in these few months, because that all happened between August and November. And also in these few months, the few times what I think now was the guy that didn't identify itself, but this incredible, lucid, wise, strong advice, and said, yes, you have a task. It didn't tell me anything more about it, but the important thing is your personal development. And what then later on came in the lectures, started telling me personally of what I have to do in finding my faults and facing my problems and really giving me the guidance how to work with myself.
In other words, you sort of had the lectures in microcosm. Before they even came up for you.
Before they came through.
Daily review and writing
my own channel writing, you know, every night, daily review. And then out of what I would write, answers would come in the automatic writing and how I should go about it. Then another thing that I was told, very soon I saw that this other woman, you know, that I knew more than she couldn't help me anymore, you know. Yet I needed her. Because I couldn't do it alone. You know, you shouldn't do that alone.
Yeah.
It's a law, a spiritual law.
You mean like you need someone, a grounded person to be there?
It's not just of course. But even not, because just the fact you're alone, you lose your perception sometimes. It's such an absorbing and fascinating thing that you could really be completely caught up and believe things that aren't, you know, and really be threatened or whatever. Anyway. Then, let me see, I have to go back a little bit. There were a few things that...
If this helped you, like, I'm curious to know how it happened that you went into a trance with music.
Well, that's much later. I have to tell a few things that were still at that time. Then, that same voice, that guidance told me, when I do a sufficient amount of groundwork in my own purification, some other people will eventually be guided to me, who can also receive help through this channel, and who will also help me by being,
supportive
and sitting with me and things like that. Then, at that time, Andre and I were about to go back to the States. And you see, he had an export job with an export company. And at that time, it was 1954. Yes, 1954. No, that was 1952 still.
I see.
He lost the job because the export firm was, they didn't, I mean, there was some political reasons that they couldn't get the, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't, it's too complicated, I don't even remember. But anyway, we had to go back to the States. He didn't have a job, and there was absolutely no logical reason to assume we would be back in the near future in Switzerland. No logical reason, because he needed a job, and you couldn't get jobs for an American citizen in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so the only way was to go back to the States. So, but in my writing came this incredible prediction. And I at that time already had learned to be weary of predictions. And it said, you will be back in the near future because you need to be here for your early training.
Uh-huh.
And there will be certain phases where you have to be back. I didn't believe that. I said, that's impossible. It doesn't make sense logically. There was one of these things I completely rejected. I put it aside. Well, in the fall of 1952, November, we went back to the States. And I wanted to resume, you know, I had had this dancing studio before, which I had given up when we went to Europe.
You mean you were teaching?
First I had been a dancing teacher, then I had the dancing studio which I was running. I had teachers working for me.
Oh.
And then after I came back from Europe, I thought I'd work again, you know. I mean, Andre didn't have that money and he needed a job and he was looking himself for a job. So there was no reason that I shouldn't support myself. But Then this thing came. And I already had automatic writing, you know, and once in a while, this automatic writing class, once in a while, somebody would come, and a friend, and she would ask questions and got incredible guidance, you know, like, that was still in Switzerland, and I was very excited about it. And then, when we came back, I got this message, now is the time you have to completely forget about it. The automatic writing, any kind of phenomenon, you have to completely concentrate on your own development and not do anything else. And you shouldn't even work for this short period of time. And I said, but how? I mean, I can't. It's not fair to you know. And Andre was very good about it. He accepted that. And so I was really, for a year and a half, totally concentrated on my own path. And the channel only functioned for that. It only told me everything, you know, that I needed to know about myself. And you see, this is why when I hear people like Anne White, they have these fabulous things, this and that, but just not telling them themselves, I'm very suspicious. Now, then, after a year and a half of really very intense training, one day it said, the first green light will be given you now. You don't have to go out and look for anybody, it'll come. And sure enough, lo and behold, an old friend of mine, we met and we talked about these things, and I didn't even have any attention, I had no idea. And then she said, what, you do this? Could you do some writing for me? Mm. So that was like the first green light. And then she and her father.
Who was this? I know you don't know them.
Oh yes, you know them. You met her last summer. She came to the center. Kitty Anninger, you remember?
Vaguely, yeah.
She came. She was one of the first people.
Thank you.
And, so, that was in New York, and that was between 1952 and 1954. And so we had then at the end, early 1954, she had a few sessions with her father, you know, and she came and I did automatic writing, and also all the things that came through, never anything phenomenal. No, at that time, more and more was just geared to help people on their own path.
Mm-hmm.
That was the early channel. Then, one day, Andre was looking for jobs. Then he found this job. That wasn't good. Nothing worked. And one day he got this offer. Julie, that might interest you. You know about the Marquis de Cuevas Ballet? Did you hear about them?
Yes.
Well, they were very famous in Paris, you know. Uh-huh. They had really very great dancers there. The Marquis de Cuevas,
they came to Egypt.
Yes, yes, they came all over. And it was the original of the Ballet de Monte Carlo, you know.
Oh.
And then the Marquis de Cuevas, they had very, very famous dancers. And he was a husband of Margaret Rockefeller, you know, of a Rockefeller. And they were very good friends with Andre. You know, Andre was high society. Almanach de Gotha and who is who. And I mean, he was this kind of level of society, high society. And Cuevas made an offer to Andre to be the manager of his ballet in Paris. And you know, I mean, all my life I was always on the fringes. First I was dancing myself, then with the Cuevas ballet, then with the Harkness ballet. Now with it's so funny, you know, that was like maybe at one time that was my task, but not in this life, but still something.
And now the Center ballet.
Yeah, Center, that's what I'm saying, Center ballet. So anyway, so he got this very interesting offer to go to Paris as a manager of the Cuevas Ballet. And from one day to the other, we found ourselves back in Europe. And then I had completely forgotten. I said, Jesus, this was what was predicted. And so then we stayed in Paris for a while, but back and forth and in Zurich, and then for a while, you know, Andre was traveling a lot with them, and somehow I was led back to Zurich, where I had been before. And this is where my training then as a medium, if you will, continued. Then the thing came, then I was guided to another girl who was also, she was my friend, you know, who was sitting with me, and she also had a channel. And
we were meeting regularly and we were into that. So, and then one day the thing came and it said, well, the time is ripe when you should start training to go into a trance. I said, I can't go into a trance. I can never go into a trance. It's impossible. Yes, yes, you can, but you have to sit, you have to train. He gave me instructions what to do. And he told me how to meditate, how to let go, how to not think, how to completely let my mind go. And he told me like twice a week I should do this regularly with this other girl present. And then after we do this, there would be a session where automatic writing would come through. And less these other spirits came, because I really learned how to handle them. And how to discriminate and how to, and what to take and what to. Then this happened less and less, and whatever came in the automatic writing was more that guidance or the guide, you know. And then I was sitting there and nothing happened. I didn't feel I could ever go into trance. I was so there. And I persevered. And after a year and a half of sitting, the first time it happened that I felt myself into a trance state.
And did you have to use music at the time, or?
Well, how did that?
Was that a suggestion to relax?
I don't even know. Well, just relaxation. We did or we didn't. That wasn't the issue. I mean, it's just a nice way to go into trance.
Yes.
That's not a point. But I can go with into a trance without music now. It's not a must, you know.
Right.
But anyway, the first time I felt the trance, nothing, no voice came through. And I was just in trance. And it was an incredible feeling. I mean, it was an incredible feeling. And from that time on, I could do it without any difficulty. And then the second time I did it, the voice came through. And from that time, the guide came. And that was toward the end of, well, the last few months. In the fall of 1956, we returned to the States. And
When the guide came through at the time, who were the people in your environment who were supportive
time,
or listening?
Yes, at that time, a small group in Zurich had formed. This girl I mentioned and two other people. Gradually they came, one brought the other. And there were maybe 6 to 8, 10 people, not more than that. And then they came regularly. And we had maybe once a week a guide session, and he gave them instructions. That was taught them the summer 1956, the spring and summer 1956, and the fall, early fall. And then one of the messages the guide said was, when you go back to the United States, a group will form around you, a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
But that will not be the nucleus of the group that will ultimately form. Later on, other people will come, and they will be the nucleus of the group that will ultimately form for the task you have to fulfill. Can you imagine?
Wow.
You couldn't even begin to invent a thing. I mean, it's so far-fetched, you know? And of course, at that time, it still didn't tell me anything about the vastness of this task. I thought I'd do that for my pastime. For friends,
right.
You know, sit to do for fun or for friends or for interest, not for fun anymore, but for interest, you know. I didn't think this would be my vocation. And then when we came back to the States in 1956, indeed, one word gave another, there was this group of people formed, you know. I remember very well who the people were.
Who were they?
Well, you don't know them.
I know. Hella?
No, they
before
were not.
Them.
Before
oh.
that. Hella was the second group, that's out of which.
Really?
The
so there were several it. Nucleus groups that formed.
Well, there was only one. There, that first group that I was saying, there were maybe 6, 8 people who were sitting together, and I gave them sort of a trance session, maybe every 2 weeks, and that was it, you know. Then, in the spring of 1957, I met Walter Heller and Marianne Skura, and they were the nucleus of the real group. And out of everybody, you can finally lead back to these two people. They brought them in.
I see.
And that's how it started.
That's incredible.
So that's, I think, roughly the early history.
Thank you. That's good.
Yeah.
Now I can come to more recent questions,
yeah.
I think. And that is, for example, what can you say about the energy you feel now from the guide as compared to the energy then?
Well, it's an unbelievably strong energy. Unbelievable. It doesn't compare. It gets stronger all the time. And purer all the time.
The other thing is, how did...
Yes?
My question is that there must be a tremendously pleasurable feeling that you have when you go into trance. Is there any way that you can describe that?
Is there any way that
well,
you hear that?
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. It's very hard to put that feeling into words. You know, usually people think of trance in terms of being not conscious. And that's not true. There may be trance states where you're really like in a sleep. This is not it. But to whatever degree I'm not conscious, it's not that I'm not conscious. I'm so conscious that I'm not conscious. I don't know if that makes any sense. It's a super focusing of consciousness. That super focusing is the channel where my own mind is out of it. And where it's really a channel for another consciousness coming through.
I feel this is sort of like we're learning this.
Yeah, which is a super focusing of consciousness, of intensification of consciousness. It sounds very contradictory. Now, for the longest time before going into trance was always a slight anxiety. And I think I talked about that, which had to do with what would come through. Will it be nonsense? Will come nothing come through? I mean, it's sort of a doubt, my own self-doubts. And then I found out that had a lot to do with my ego, and as I let go and just gave over to the will of God, that I lost that anxiety. And I feel very confident now. And the real pleasurable feeling is when I come out of it. And the feeling is like of a tremendous accomplishment and a tremendous influx of new energy.
Just to change the modality for a second.
Yeah.
Someone said to me that the only time you ever canceled a guide lecture,
yeah,
was when one of the cats died.
Yes.
You talk about that and also your relationship to psyche and...
That was the psyche,
there's a meaning. But there's a meaning, yeah, to your cats or your family.
Yes. Who told you that?
Judith.
That's funny. That's true.
It's amazing. Do or die, you're there, you know?
Yes. Well, it was the day the cat died and I was very upset. I love my cats, yeah, and I have a very special relationship to them. And I found out through my dreams that my cats have a very strong symbolic representation for me. My old cats, Patsy and Mickey, was very interesting. Patsy was the male and Mickey was the female. And Patsy died, and somehow that was like a foreshadowing of the end of my relationship with Andre, which was very painful. But of course I didn't know it at that time. And I just mourned Patsy. And then if you ask me about my relationship with my cats and my dreams, Mickey, well, Patsy was the male principal, which was, you know, man, and Mickey was the female principal within myself. And it was very interesting. Before I met John, right after I met John, Mickey died. And then I got Psyche.
Nice.
And I knew that Mickey died, it was the old, my old symbolic femininity that was already sick and died, and the new birth of my femininity came with Psyche. That was much more beautiful and vigorous. Not that I didn't love Mickey, I loved her. You took a photograph of her.
Yes, you have it hanging.
You remember?
Yes, I do. Listen, I'll let you ask you this. I know you've had three major, crossroads in your life. And
yes.
What I can think of is, one was, and if you want to talk about, one of course was a guide coming through.
Yeah.
The other one was
the operation.
Yes. And the third thing was your recent change of voice, which opened you up to your
yes.
receptivity.
Right.
If you could talk about those three points. Or,
Well, the guide I already talked about.
Yeah, we had the lecture, we can. But,
then, no, but I think there was another major point. Yes, that was around the... That is all part of the time of the operation, because that wasn't the only thing that happened at that time. That was the most crisis time in my life.
Right.
And it was an incredible crossroad on my part. But everything bad happened. You know, like the mystics talk about the dark night of the... The dark night, you know, it's an expression of the mystic thing. A dark night of the soul. Well, that's what happened then. It was the end of the relationship with André, which was very painful, I said that. Walter Heller and Annie Heller and Rosen. And there were a few people who you don't know. The names don't really matter.
I remember those. I knew
them. Some of them you knew. And I had a lot of dissension with
Nathan.
Them. And Helen Aroff. And a lot of very negative things happened. And they were really the pillars that they supported me. And the dissension was very, very painful. And suddenly I found myself alone.
It sounds like the Okay.
Then, along with that, you see, that was also when the Patsy died, and that was before, but still. I mean, it was also the Patsy died, and there was
everything
the end of it,
and
everything
once.
Sort of happened. And then, along with that, it was like an incredible facing my own doubts about this channel and about what it means, and a lot of doubts I hadn't faced. And it was very difficult for me to do that. And I did it, you know, I really said, well, I have to face this. What is true, what is not, where does it come from? And you know, like Jane Roberts describes that too, where she goes into these doubts, where does it all come from?
These are tests.
Yeah, right. Tests. And that was very painful. Then this happened with my operation. Of course, I hardly need to say how painful that was. And I thought it was really the end of my life as a woman. And all of that happened. Around the same time, you know. And then I had dreams that foreshadowed it at that time, and like, you know, tremendous big deep dreams. And it was a total period of turmoil, of testing, of really, if I wouldn't have gone through the test, the thing would never have, the path would never have developed.
It sounded like an ultimate test when you really had to...
Test. I mean, first the channel started and people came and it was good and lovely lectures started already to come and help was given, although the help at that early time was only given in trance sessions. I didn't have the knowledge as a helper. I learned the knowledge as a helper through the trance sessions that the guide gave. So that's what happened for a while, you know. And then these tests came. This tremendous upheaval, this dark night. And I went going really through a dark night. And then I came out of that and, you know, then a few years, that's about it.
Now, what about the recent, Well, the voice is obviously a new change, which I feel you're just coming into.
It's a new change of energy level. I had, let's see. Well, no, actually, it started in the spring. I think it must have been May.
Maybe since the marathon,
well,
perhaps.
Well, I didn't, no, it was not the marathon. It was before the marathon. I think I had you know, when I started that virus.
Oh, yeah.
That was in May. And in May, I had this unbelievable Christ experience in the center.
Oh, yes.
I think I told you all about that. And then after that, this energy was so incredible, then I got that virus. And that I carried that for months. I couldn't get rid of it. I wasn't sick, but I had the virus. You know?
Couldn't talk?
No, that wasn't talking. That came only now. The laryngitis came, I think it was about 2 months ago. But there was an extension of the same thing. And it's really getting into a new energy level. But it's not a time like that, you know, like that other time. It's just,
it's a softer, it's not even a crisis.
Yeah.
Okay, now to go back a little bit.
In a sense, physically, it is a crisis also.
Yeah. Just to go back a little bit, how did John get into the picture?
Well, John got into the picture through the Alpers, you know that.
No, I didn't.
You didn't know that?
No. Now that you mention it, I mean, oh my God.
Bert Alper was John's patient.
I see.
And one day, Bert Alper came to John.
Well, he was brought there by?
By Ranger Hamilton.
Right.
Ranger
right.
Hamilton is the psychologist who came to me repeatedly.
Right.
For her patients.
And she was a marriage counselor or something.
She was
like
a marriage counselor, she was a writing therapist. She knew John, but she didn't tell John about it. I think it's very, very funny. I met Ranger Hamilton through Helen Aroff, who was quite a famous violinist, and who was on the path, and he was one of the people I had the trouble with. She introduced Ranger to me, Dr. Hamilton, you know. And she was very interested in this channel, and whenever she had trouble with patients and couldn't go any further, she came to the guide. And the guide would tell her what to do. And then she would go, and she would, I mean, it was unbelievable. You know?
You mean Eleanor was brought to you by Bert?
Well, Eleanor was a Ranger Hamilton's patient.
That's right.
And Bert was John's patient.
Oh, that's how they, yes.
And then Bert
married Eleanor.
Well, yeah, they were married already at that time. Anyway, Bert Appleton came one day to John, and I said, he brought him about 20 lectures. And he said, I know this medium, and it's a fantastic channel. And John, when he heard medium, he didn't want any part of it. He said, well, you know, it was very
another
doubtful.
Another one, yeah.
And first he talked about it. Didn't bring the lectures right away. And then Bert said, no, but read these lectures. And he said, okay, and he read the lectures, and he was totally enthusiastic. He said, that is incredible. That's what I was looking for all my life. And he said, that's all meat and no potatoes. That was the expression he used. That is incredible. And then he asked Bert Alper for my address. And he wrote me, and I remember exactly, I came back from the Harkness in Watch Hill on the 4th of July in the summer of 1966. And I found John Piracus's letter. And he said, I'm a New York psychiatrist, and I read some of your lectures, and they're incredible material, and I would like to get all the available material I can and purchase all the lectures, and I'd like to talk to you. So that's how I met him.
That's amazing. So you started to come to the lectures?
Well, then, yes, of course.
Now, how did, if I may ask, the romance start?
Well, you may ask, it's no secret. Well then, then he wrote me the letter, he said, did call, I don't know, no, he said, how was it, in the letter, he said he wants to buy the lectures, yes, and that's it. Then I answered him, I said yes, and I gave him the information, and so and so many lectures, and they're available, and if he wants to call me, I'll be glad to talk to him, you know. And then he called me up, and we made an appointment. And I remember Jose helped me pick out all the lectures, you know, about, I don't know how many lectures there were at that time, maybe 100, 50 or 110, I don't know. So we prepared all the lectures, and then John came, and when he opened the door, and he stood there, I had immediately a feeling of incredible sympathique, you know?
Yeah.
And we started talking, and he asked me, and he told me about himself, and then he said something, like he told me that he felt he had betrayed Reich. And you know, it was the kind of thing you would say when you're on the path. And I said, my God. And at that moment, I said, gee, I had such a feeling for him, you know? And I saw him that, I thought, this man is incredible. And then I found out he was married. I said, oh, forget it, that's ridiculous, you know? This was it, and yet all my mind, my conscious mind said, forget it. And
which sounded like a tremendous mutuality.
Incredible. I mean, there was such a rapport and such an understanding. He was just completely the man I wanted. I was looking for that man, you know, except that he was married. Then he asked, then I was going away. It was the summer, and I was going to Watch Hill. And he said, well, let's get together when we get back. I'd like to talk to you some more. And also, I would very much like to have a guide session. And I want to talk, ask a lot of things. And, oh, and I forgot, there was another very interesting thing. That was maybe a year before. There was this woman, an English woman, a palm reader. And you know, I'm really usually not turned on to that thing at all. She was her name was Diane Elliott. Eric knows her, Elizabeth knows her. Rebecca Harkness recommended, said, go to Diane Elliott. She's a fantastic woman. She had a little studio in Carnegie Hall, you know, where we had the lectures for a while. So I went to see her. And it was maybe a year or two, or even more than that, before I met John. No, more than a year before. That was maybe, must have been maybe 62 or 63 when I went there. And Diane, I walked into the room. She's a beautiful English, very spiritual woman. And I walked into the room, and she immediately said, she didn't know me from Adam. She told me about my spiritual channel. She said, you have a fantastic channel. She read the lectures after that. She was very interested. Then she looked at my hand, and she told me fantastic things about my past. Everything correct, absolutely everything. Then she said, you are going to meet a psychiatrist this summer. The only thing that was wrong was the time. And he's very into energy field and very scientific. He's not only doing psychiatry, but he's also very much into the scientific aspects of the energies. And you're getting married. You're going to get, he's a widower. That's another thing she was wrong, you know. Sometimes things come true, but it's he's a widower. And you're going to get married, and you're going to have a fantastic relationship, a very beautiful marriage. And he has two daughters. And the third thing that was wrong was that you have a lovely relationship with the daughters, which is another thing that's wrong. But everything else came, yes. And then she said, when you come back from the summer, you're going to meet this man, and you will have a conversation with him. That was in 1962 or 3. And you will find it's the most stimulating conversation you ever had. And of course, I was waiting for this man. He didn't come. Summer 1963, nothing. 64, nothing. 65, nothing. I forgot it. I said, oh, that's nonsense. You know, I gave up. I completely forgot about it. I said, these things don't believe in these predictions. She was great when it came to the thing that were, but not the thing that would be. And I still believe very many times, don't bother with predicting future, but once in a while it happened. So anyway, I had put that out of my mind. Then when I saw John the second time, after we came back from the summer, you know, and we spent an evening and talked. And at the end of the talk, he used the word. He said, well, that was the most stimulating conversation I ever had. And I said, oh my God, this popped into my mind. I said, what did you say? I was like, he said, what's the matter? Why, don't you agree? I said, yes, but I didn't want to say anything to him, you know?
Yeah.
And still I kept saying all the time, he's married, forget it, forget it. And then we made an appointment, and then we had dinner together, and we made an appointment that for a guide session. And he said, what's your fee? And I said, you know, like an inner voice that told me, he said, I want to work with you, I need this help. And like an inner voice that told me, if I take him on as a worker, there can never be anything between us. And I said, I don't want that. I said, no fee, but I also want to learn from you, which I really meant, you know. So it was like an inner voice, because if I had said, he would come as a worker, that would have been the end. I know that, you know, because that cut the sin. And I didn't want to do that in spite of the fact, I mean, something in me didn't, you know, I mean, it was so, the feeling was so strong. And yet my mind said, he's married, forget it. Then he had a guide session. And in the guide session, hadn't mentioned that to me, but he talked to the guide a lot about some of his problems, and one of them was that he was very, very miserable in the marriage that had no way out, you know? And that was the first time I opened myself up to this. And that's how it started.
It's beautiful. A question I have now is, I don't know how you could answer it, but, and I know there was a lecture, sort of a message, you know, the thing called the message, that you,
yes.
An inspiration you had one.
Yeah.
But someone related to this, how do you visualize the center or the path in the year 2000, which is 24 years
ago? Yeah, I don't even think about that.
You don't?
I tell you, I've learned not to think that way, because I could have foreseen the times I told you about what is happening now. In my wildest dreams, I couldn't have conceived of it. I just don't think about it. I know it's going to be a beautiful thing and it's going to expand, but about the details, I just don't think.
I think it is moving towards an expansion. It's obvious. And
well,
a
that's
lot of
obvious. You
helpers are trained.
You don't have to be clairvoyant to see that.
All right. One more thing I'd like to ask, and that is, Arosa.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I know it has a special significance,
oh, yes.
You know. And I wonder, you know, in English I think of the
yes.
word arising, you know?
Yeah.
Somehow it's the same.
Arose, yeah.
Yeah. What is the meaning for you, for all of us, for the Arosa?
Well, let me see.
Or even from
yeah.
a practical standpoint,
yeah.
like you used to go there when
yes.
you were young and you went back and...
Well, Arosa didn't go when I was young, but other places I went when I was young. Well, let's put it this way. In 1963, my mother died. Before she was alive, but as long as she was alive, between, I don't know, 61 and 60, 60 and 63, anyway, I went every year in the summer with my sister to Europe to visit her. And then we combined that with some vacation. Then in 63, in the spring of 63, she died. And then I somehow had the idea, instead of going away in the summer, I want to get a ski vacation. And I went with my aunt Escura in 64 to St. Moritz. And in 65, we went to Arosa. And I loved it so much there that I mean, I've been in many other ski resorts, and none of them compared for my money.
It's a very peaceful place.
It's
compared to the
it's
other.
It's everything. It's peaceful. It's beautiful. It's sunny. It has a thousand advantages that I find don't know the other places don't have, and I got hooked on it. And at that time, for me, it was just a necessary vacation and respite and refueling and regeneration. And all vacations always were an incredible preparation for some new phase on the path, in myself and on the path. Then I went there in 1965 and 6 with Marianne. And then in 1967, I already knew John, but of course he didn't come. And of course he had never skied in his life. And I went there, you know, I knew John, but I went there in 1967 and 1968 he didn't come. Or was it only, I don't know when he started the first time in 68 and 69. I think 69 he came the first time.
Later.
But anyway, in the years I knew him and I went there without him, I said, I had such a thing, oh, I wish I could show this to him. I wish I could share this with him. And whenever I told him, you know, he wasn't particularly turned on. In Greece and mountains and snow, it had no meaning for him. But I knew it would be incredible if he saw it. Then in 1969, I think, was the first time he came. And that was also the time he finally left his first wife and we moved in together. And when he saw it, that was it too, you know. He started skiing, he took lessons, he had never skied in his life. But after about 10 days he began, of steady lessons, he began to enjoy it, that after the first tediousness was over. And then in 1970, we went there together alone. I think Marianne was there too. And my brother came and visited, Albert, you know, from whom the same
right,
money
right.
came.
I want to ask
and
about.
He came and visited us there. And it was an incredibly deep and meaningful experience on every level, you know. The beauty outwardly, the rest outwardly, the inner spiritual regeneration and the preparation for a new thing. And then we said, my God, John and I had the idea, we wish we could share that with our friends. And then we brought the first year, Bill and Claire and Bert and Moira. They were the first ones to come. And that's how it started.
And then it became sort of a...
I think they came the first time in 71 or 72, and I'm not quite sure.
And the way it is today, it's sort of a...
It's a focusing,
yes. You say.
It's every year something happens there that's opening up, you know. And then something new is born there, like the center.
Okay, no, I think that I covered most of the questions. Yeah. I thought maybe if some people in the car here wanted to ask a question, and if Eva still wanted to oblige,
okay.
Is there someone, Albert perhaps, or Judy?
I can say that when I hear the story, I am in just amazement, you know, and awe at what you know, the potentials in each one of us, and that the problems that I have and I'm going through, which seems so enormous to me, when I hear this story, they become very obvious and very solvable. It's really an inspiring story, and it fills me with hope.
I really want to thank you too. I tell you, this is inspiring.
Really? Is
yeah.
It
like, yeah.
I tell you, and at the same time, I feel I even couldn't even do justice to it because it's so hard to explain these early beginnings and the groping and how I didn't know anything then, you know, and not knowing these things. Really, a lot of these things I had to find out the hard way. by trial and error.
I tell you, it's almost comparable to going to space for the first time,
not knowing
as compared to the rest of us following and doing the same thing.
Yes.
And our struggle, the reason I really wanted to, I wanted people to be able to identify their struggle when they start to be exposed to the guide.
I mean, I think when people have the jealousy of me and I have the guide and why they could sit down and do it and this and can't, they really have no conception that even though it's surely much easier now for them than it was for me then, because the path is outlined and they have the help. However, before establishing, as I said, there are a lot of tests and a lot of things to go through. But it's 100,000 times worth it. I wouldn't want to go back and not do it again. I mean, if I would love to do it again anytime, even the most difficult thing. For what it is.
If I may say this, it makes me think how we take this phenomenon, you know, this beautiful thing we have, the guide, we take the guide for granted in a certain way. Let me ask the guide this, and let me ask the guide that. And when I hear this story, I realize the incredible gift that is available to us. And that we really have to maybe give it much more reverence and respect, and it's I have of course a lot of respect, but it's like there is another level where I can really really give it the best that I have and make the maximum out of it.
Judy, did you have a question or something to say? No. Well, Eva, I want to thank you, and I feel the same thing out there saying, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a story that could be told over and over again, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, I think I know there was a tape of it, and I just like to hear it again. I'm glad we could do it this way, you know?
You know, but perhaps also is very important for many people. I think two things are perhaps the most important things. One is what I just said before, that this doesn't come so easy. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's much easier now, but it's a struggle, but it's a beautiful struggle, and nobody should imagine that there's no struggle about it. But the second thing I think may be very important here is that people have very preconceived ideas about, that's why I don't like the word medium.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not mediumship.
Really. It's not mediumship in that sense, but whatever you call it.
It's more like a channel.
Have, you know, they have a preconceived idea that you have, you're a spiritual person in the usual sense. I wasn't that way at all. I had it inwardly probably, otherwise it wouldn't have come, but it wasn't manifest, you know?
And that's what appealed to me. I remember Bert Alper,
yeah,
that I didn't feel I was going to a seance, per se.
Yeah, exactly.
It was somehow the first thing in my life that really it was somehow both spiritual and very grounded.
Very grounded and very earthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why somehow I was chosen for this particular task, because I combined the two elements.
Yeah, most people probably would have gone with the other voices.
Well, you see what happened in there. Look at it with Anne White, the splitting off. You see it all over with spiritual people. They split off from their sexuality.
Oh, yes.
From their practical earth life. They forsake that, and that's exactly what it should not be.
Yes.
I think that this is what... Sorry, Charles. I think that this is what differentiates the New Age spirituality with the Old Age spirituality. We're going to into an area where the spirituality penetrates and purifies the material and manifests, you know, on a very real level. And that's what the New Age is all about, as opposed to, up to now, the spiritual people had to sort of disconnect with earthly things in a certain way because of the overtly, you know, crass physicality of earlier periods in history.
I'm reminded of another thing I wanted to ask or talk about, and that is, we are this Wednesday at this time, point in time, having Peter Caddy and Eileen Caddy from Finnhorn come over, and they visited us before, and I feel very excited about us sort of touching our hands somehow, and wanting to share what we've gone through, you know?
Yes.
And how do you feel? I mean, I know...
Really wonderful, Bob. Terrific. I'm very fond of both of them. I love them. I love particularly Eileen, but also Peter.
Yeah.
I think they're wonderful people. And, I mean, I said that so many times, it's redundant. I mean, we have to learn from each other.
Right.
And I feel also that the path has a very particular contribution to make that I haven't found in any other spiritually oriented light center. I haven't found
it. Well, that's it. What I find particularly exciting, though, is that Finnhorn is the only one who we are all interested to visit. You
right.
said you went to them, and that's what I like beautiful is that there were no other centers that were grounded or.
Right.
Okay, so I think that's it. There's a question about your views on childbearing. Obviously, at some point...
It has nothing to do with views, you know?
Well, you felt...
Yeah, no, I mean, my feeling was... well, as it happened, there was... The guidance was such that there really was... It wasn't right for me to have a child. I mean, there were outer circumstances that could be used as a rationale, like when I was first married to my first husband, it would have been unthinkable. We came to this country, we had very little money, we were living in a brownstone house in a one-room furnished apartment. He was looking for a job, we were new in the country, I was working. I mean, it would have been crazy to have a child then. There was the war, you know, what was going on, and he was inducted. I mean, it would have been absolutely insane. Then, after the war, we were divorced gradually. Then I met Andre. Andre was married to someone else, but separated. He would have wanted a child illegitimate, which I didn't feel like having. At that time, I would have liked to have a child, but I wanted to have, I mean, not that way. Also, there was very little money, and looking back, it would have been impossible. I couldn't have gone through that spiritual training had I had a child.
Yes.
I couldn't have. So I realized this life, it's not, you know. That was not right, this life.
Okay.
And it's funny, I noticed with many, you know, many of the, for instance, Jane Roberts has no child, except Eileen Caddy, but many, many of the others, another Eileen Garrett, who was a very, very famous sensitive, you know. I mean, there's many of them. There seems to be some...
But it seems to be almost like your creative output is so
that's
phenomenal.
Right.
That
it's constantly
it goes
giving
into
birth.
There.
Yes, it's a constant giving birth on another level. I don't mind answering this question.
I know he was closely connected to...
Thomas Mann.
Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse, weren't they sort of a triangle?
Not Hermann Hesse,
oh, Elie Wiesel.
No, Thomas Mann and Arthur Schnitzler. It was
I see.
Viennese, Indiana, very famous.
What is his most famous book? Is it who wrote the Movavius case?
Mauritius. That's my father.
That's...
Yeah, case Mauritius.
Yes, and that, I've seen that around. That's
yeah.
the book.
No, I mean, it was very, very much of a very, very known all over the world years ago.
What about Albert?
Albert,
I'm
my
sorry.
Brother.
Yes.
What about him?
Because I know, well, we have the room called after him.
Yeah.
Some people don't know who he is, really.
Well,
you know.
He was a scientist, in biochemistry. He was teaching in London University. He was a lovely human being. and that's all I can say. He died in a plane crash in 1971.
And then some of the money was
the inheritance that I made it possible to start the center. It was the main money that went in. The largest amount of money was that.
How I neglect daily review. And it's so important.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't work enough on myself. I could work much more on myself. You know? And when I hear you that you've gone through all of this, and the tremendous rewards, you know, rewards that you get out of that, out of purification, it's unbelievable. And it doesn't have to be just for any purpose. You're doing it for yourself, and you know that's where the groundedness comes in.
You know, what I'm taken back by is things you hear now about taking small steps.
Yeah.
It's amazing how you really took very small steps.
Yes.
With no idea how far it will go.
None.
But you carried everything to completion. It's all an entity. I remember when I started the path about 13, 14 years ago, I mean, I felt it had reached its zenith, you know?
Yeah, right.
And we all felt that. I was like, my God, each lecture kept getting more. This is it. This is the one that's going to be.
After 5 years, I said, well, now we have everything. I don't know what the guide could say more.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I couldn't imagine what more could be said.
There's a famous quotation about, I think this is about a poet, I don't know who it was, it said, people like you should live 1,000 years.
Hmm.
You know?
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you. I must have been a dancer probably many times in previous incarnations. And it's like I carried this with me. And like at the beginning of my life, I still manifested that. And only as I developed would I then come into what my task was to be now. You know, that's the way I see it. But I have a very strong affinity for dancing, and I always keep that, you know. I mean, but doesn't mean that was meant to be my vocation. And it even manifests in a strange way, you know, as I said before, always bringing me close to, in some way, to dancing, to dance companies and...
That's very important.